You're listening to radio station KPFT in Houston, HD2 channel. You're also listening over the internet at executionwatch.org, kpft.org from the link, and from the link on theprisonshow.org. I'm Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. Tonight we've scheduled, Texas has scheduled the execution of a 42-year-old former New Yorker by the name of Denard Shea Manns. He was condemned for the killing, raping, robbing, shooting of Michelle Christine Robinson in her home in Killeen, Texas. On the radio, on the phone right now from Huntsville, we have Kelly Epstein. Kelly, are you there?
Yeah, I am, Ray. It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, they just went in about 3 minutes ago, the group of media, small group, only I think three people. There's been no witnesses for him, apparently. And we expect him to be coming back out in 15, 16 minutes. They seem to run on this regular schedule. There's four of us out here on the corner keeping vigil and... wishing we were someplace else, I think.
Kelly, you're a journalist, right?
No, I'm not. I'm a volunteer social worker.
A volunteer social worker. why do you do this?
I do it for a number of reasons, but basically I'm tired of having this terrible thing take place here and not speak out, having people do it in my name, and I want to say, no, you don't do it in my name. I don't like this. I don't want it. So just kind of voicing my objection to this very obscene act that Texas does.
Now, who you've got tonight is, I would probably say, the likely suspects. It's a pretty hardcore crowd.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
As it is the likely suspects tonight, it's a pretty regular crowd, right?
Yes, it is. And you know, Ray, that it really, whether or not there's a question of innocence, it's just the execution itself that we regard as so very terrible. Last night was interesting. The mother of the condemned was here, and that's very, very difficult. Very hard to be with a mother when her son is being killed.
And she wasn't a witness, but she was at the demonstration?
She was here at the corner with her daughter-in-law. The stepfather and two brothers were witnesses for George Whitaker last night.
Okay. Well, listen, if anything happens, get back in touch with Elizabeth so that we can report this. And thank you very much for joining Execution Watch tonight.
You're welcome, Ray. Bye.
Bye-bye. And let's see. There you go. And oops. Yeah, that's what you do. Right. And so I'm going to bring Jim in. Jim, you've had a look at this case?
Yes, sir.
What's...
Let me give you the rundown. As you mentioned, he was raised in New York and is a white guy from Harlem, raised around Harlem. And apparently, he was involved in a lot of robberies in New York. He was nicknamed the Subway Robber because his MO, apparently, from according to the police in New York, he'd get on subways and he'd find somebody alone, he'd rob them. And he ended up being charged overall with at least 15 armed robberies in New York. He spent two terms in penitentiary, once for robbery, second time for robbery. And he worked him down to at least only two cases. And what happened, he paroled out in 1998, and he decided, at least he said then, he was going to got permission to move from New York to be transferred to Texas. And he moved to Texas, moved in with his half-brother, a kid named Bramberg, and a cousin by the name of Eric Williams. And they lived in Killeen, and he moved in with them. And there's nothing, at least in the appellate record, about where he was working during this period of time. 3 months after he moved here, his next-door neighbor, a lady named Michelle Robinson, she was a medic in the Army, and she was from...
Yeah, the big thing about Killeen is that big base is there. It's one of
Port
the largest
there.
Bases in the country.
Fort Hood. And she was from Iowa. She had a college degree, and she'd married a GI by the name of Clay Willingstein. And he had gone out of town. Apparently, he'd gone to Upper State New York to visit his family. And what happened, she didn't show up for work one morning, and her commanding officer went by to see her and found her in a bathtub. She had been bound with electric cord pulled out of a wall, had been shot five times in the back of the head with a .22. And they claimed she was kneeling when she shot, but they found her body inside of a bathtub. So, like I say, she lived three doors down from where Manns lived, along with his brother and cousin. So what happened, the cousin Eric Williams had a .22 pistol. When he heard that the neighbor had been shot with a .22 pistol that evening, he found a .22 pistol billet or cartridge on the floor, and he didn't know how it got there. And he ended up calling the police, since there's a .22 used in this particular killing. The police picked up the .22, and according to them, one of the bullets matched the bullet, one of the bullets that went in. They couldn't identify all of them, but they said the gun matched the bullets ballistically.
Yeah, there was something in that ballistics report that said 22 bullets tend to shatter when
No, he said that. That was later on. He made this statement to a guy in jail. And I don't know if you know much about killing, but the preferred weapon of many assassins is a 22 bullet because it shatters when it hits bone, and it's really hard to team it up with ballistics. That's always been the weapon of choice.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you ever heard of a double tap?
No.
Double tap's what the Dixie Mafia used to do. Call it two shots in the back of the head. They'd call it a double tap, and it's always with a .22. That's been the sign of a Dixie Mafia hit for years. Anyway, what happened, they found a fingerprint of Eric Williams, the man who owned the gun and turned it over to the police, plus they also found a fingerprint on Denard Manns. Then what happened
is... The fingerprint was on the gun.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And then what happened, the evidence produced at trial was as follows. He was arrested about a month later. And what happened, there was sperm found on the dead lady's brassiere that matched the DNA profile of man. And then also the day after the lady was killed, man had gone by a friend's house and left a jacket there that belonged to the dead person. And then after that, he dropped like a canister can and had a bunch of jewelry in it, and a lot of the jewelry belonged to her. So what led the police to him primarily was the fingerprint, the DNA, the fact that he had properties of her, property of her after the killing occurred. So he's arrested about a month later, and he's taken to jail, and he denies everything. He's always denied being involved in the killing. And they ended up charging him with capital murder, and then after he was convicted, he refused to show up for the punishment hearing. You know, Killeen's a kind of a tough town anyway, and he's refused to attend the punishment hearing. You can do that if you want to, and they can go on without you, and that's exactly what they did and gave him the death sentence, because they proved up not only all the prior robberies in New York State, but numerous other offenses that he had committed. So there was a whole bunch, and plus he was absent. He's refused to come to court for the punishment hearing. And that's pretty much what happened at trial.
Anything remarkable in the appeals?
There's a couple of things that are interesting. The first thing he argued, of course, that the evidence was insufficient because the initial suspect in this case was his half-brother. He was living at the house. Mm-hmm. And he tried to lay it off on his half-brother. And he tried to argue that he had more access to the gun than the brother had equal access to the gun. But unfortunately, the half-brother's fingerprint was not on the gun. And he tried to argue that DNA was a big mistake. What really hurt him was the DNA and having the property. At trial, he testified it in guilt or innocence. And he claimed that he'd got the jacket from a burglar that belonged to the dead lady. And he also claimed he bought the jewelry from some crackhead in Killeen. And that's why he ended up with the jewelry. And so what happened during the trial, the first part of the appeal, they just weighed the evidence, whether or not it was, you know, what it made him look like he's guilty and what it made him look like he's not guilty, and said the evidence is more than factually sufficient. But the most interesting thing was, and this is one of those things that everybody's real touchy about, when he was in jail, there was an inmate in jail with him, and the inmate's name is Ray Broom, B-R-O-O-M-E. And Ray Broom apparently is an old in and out of jail all the time, and apparently pretty wise to the way things work, because on prior occasions he testified for the state in a murder case trying to get his charges reduced.
Mm-hmm.
He earlier had worked a deal on informing on inmates on a drug case and testified, and he was in and out of jail most of his life. And in this particular case, he contacted his lawyer, and here's what he tells him. He was known as the jailhouse lawyer, Broom was.
Yeah.
He claims that Manns came to him and said, "Looky, I want to talk to you about my case." He said, "They picked up a pistol, and they picked up the murder weapon, and it's a .22, and the reason .22s are used because bullets don't shatter. The unfortunate thing was only the killer knew about the .22. It was never published in the media, so that was one of the things that hurt him." because he testified that as a 22 pistol, he was the one that made the remark that 22 bullets shatter.
So he would have known that. The only thing he didn't consider is that that was not general public information.
Right. He didn't, when he said that, they had not released that information to the media. And then he got a letter from his half-brother. Apparently his half-brother had as many problems with the law as he did, because he was in jail at the time. That was a half-brother he moved in with. When he got the letter, he showed the letter to Broom and said, "This is the man who delivered these people to me on a silver platter when I killed that woman." So what he has are these statements he made to Broom. Of course, Broom immediately contacts his lawyer, who immediately contacts the DA, and they start cutting a deal to try to get Broom out of trouble, because Broom at that time was on a motion to revoke parole and had a DWI case pending. And so the big flap in that case is whether or not he was a government agent, whether or not I could use that statement. And the law is real clear. On a situation like that, the police can put a plan in your jail cell.
Yeah.
There's no problem with that. But they're supposedly not to pump the defendant. They're supposed to be like a listening post, is what the law says.
Mm-hmm.
If they try to pump the cellmate, then they become an agent for the state, and that violates the Sixth Amendment. But if they keep their mouth shut and just listen and don't pump him for information, any statements he made, shame on him. In this particular case, they claim that these statements were not made in response to Broom asking questions, that these statements were made just spontaneously, and therefore they would be admissible. That was one of the big flaps they had.
And Killeen is what county?
Killeen's in Bell County.
Bell County. And any questions about the quality of representation?
Apparently not, because, like I say, they said nothing about any rival DNA testing. And another thing that came up, and this is the only thing I can see that a mistake, whether a glaring mistake was made, but it's not serious. They've started video filming him, and it was really funny when they picked him up. They handcuffed him, threw him in the back of the police car, and they said, "You're not arrested. You know,
yeah, right.
We're not arresting you.
We're not arresting you. We're just taking you down for questioning, and you can talk your way out of this."
It's that old deal, like, because you walk like a duck and quack like a duck, don't think you're a duck, is one of those deals. And so they said, "We're not arresting you," and they take him to jail, and then they unhandcuff him, and then they start video filming him. And he'd given them a different name. He'd given the name of Charles Manns rather than his first name, because he had a parole warrant out for him.
Uh-huh.
So when they were talking to him, they saw him on video film trying to burn his fingers with a cigarette to disguise his fingerprints. And all that was on video film. Do you have a call? You need to take care of that call.
Yeah, we've got Dave. Dave?
Yes.
Okay. Where are you and what's going on?
Well, Ray, we're out at the corner of Ben's and Main again by the museums. Got a small group tonight. We only got three people here, but it's the faithful three, I guess.
Well, you've got one less than they have in Huntsville, because the report from Huntsville, there are four folks out there.
Yeah.
And they are somewhat relieved, because last night they had the mother of the person to be executed with them. And they don't have any relatives at all tonight to comfort.
Okay. Well, there's just three of us here, but boy, the traffic is extremely heavy because, you know, Thursday night is the night when the museum is free.
Yeah.
So we got busloads of people coming in, and probably, I'd say, almost twice as much traffic as last night. And, you know, you could get discouraged with just three people, but I just had a lady stop her car, and I think she was in there maybe with her daughter, and rolled down the window and says, "Well, what do we do?" And so we had a conversation while she was waiting for the light to change. And, you know, I said, "Talk to your legislator and speak out on this issue." So you sometimes wonder how much good you're doing, but every now and then when you have a conversation like that with people, and you know that your signs are being seen by hundreds and hundreds of different people. So, you know, I always try to stay upbeat, although the group is small, that we're having an impact, and I do believe we are.
Well, I spent this morning screening a press showing of the documentary Milk, about Harvey Milk in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And it reminded me of my old activist roots. And so let me tell you something. You need to make a placard with an oversized wording of your website. because that's one thing passerbys can do with or without rolling down their window.
Right. That's a great idea. That's a great idea.
And that
we'll
can
do that. We'll do that, Ray. That's
that great. Can lead them to where they can get involved. And,
right.
Excuse my suggesting activism on this valuable show, but I want you to know that tell everyone there that we here appreciate their being there.
I'll surely do that.
The very reason that we are doing Execution Watch is because we feel that these things ought not happen in silence and in a vacuum.
Absolutely.
That we need to stand up and stand up together, and we're all pulling on the same end of the rope. This is the one assignment in my journalistic career where I make no claim of neutrality.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks, Ray. We really appreciate it. We appreciate your show, and Elizabeth, and you're all, you know, it's just great to get the word out. And I just tell people, you know, when things look grim, like they do right now with all these executions, just keep on working at it. And like Jesse Jackson says, I guess, keep hope alive, keep going, because I do think that we're changing people's minds and hearts on this issue, and it's just a matter of time.
Dave, we have three in a row scheduled for next week.
I know. It's
Tuesday,
hard.
Wednesday, and Thursday. What is that website, by the way?
www.tcadp.org, O-R-G.
And TCDAP stands for Texas
Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
If that helps you remember it, and we would encourage those listening to use it.
Yep.
Thank you, Dave. We may not be back in touch with you, but I'll have Elizabeth let you know when the process is over.
All right. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's such a clinical phrase. I'll let you know when the process is over. I don't know. You know, I'm learning language for this particular assignment, and the process, it sounds almost as mechanical as the way the state takes it to be. This is a very rigid, ritualized process. And for me to say, I'll let you know when the process is over, sounds to me like I'm buying into their mindset. And I don't want to do that. I don't know this fellow. It doesn't make me any difference whether he's guilty or innocent. Just the chance that we would once in a while execute an innocent person is something that upsets me. And I have had friends of mine executed from death row that I believed were innocent. And I know a lot of people that were executed on death row whose processes were not adequate, so we don't know whether they were guilty or innocent. Anything happened in the writ on this one?
Okay, let me finish up what we were talking about. What had happened after they video filmed him, and the reason they tell him that they weren't under arrest, because I'm assuming, of course, the opinion doesn't say that they didn't have probable cause to arrest him. They worried that an illegal arrest might lead to a suppression of a confession. They were hoping to get a confession out of him. And of course, they got no confession. So during the trial itself, the state did not introduce the video film showing the whole conversation, the whole interrogation. And then when he took the stand and testified, he testified as to, you know, where he got the property, how he got it, and he didn't do the killing. On cross-examination, the prosecutor asked him about him trying to burn his fingers to hide his fingerprints. He denied doing that. Then the judge permitted that portion of the video film to come into evidence. The reason that was a mistake is real simple, is that you cannot, on cross-examination, set up a question is an excuse to get in normally inadmissible evidence. That objection was not made. But I'm not sure whether that made any great impact on the case one way or the other. But if he'd have made the correct objection, because you cannot, that used to call the old straw man, where you set up something on cross-examination as an excuse to get in, because they're the ones that brought it up.
Sure.
And then they run back in to use the film to impeach you. It's really what they call a collateral matter. And that wasn't objected to. And that court poured out, they waived error on that case. And then when he testified, and this is just a mistake that lawyers make fairly often, they had a hearing, because before he testified, he'd only been convicted twice. And back then, the rule was, if you had any felony conviction or misdemeanor involving moral turpitude within the last 10 years, would be admissible. Now that rule has changed. But back then, they had those two convictions, and the state intended to prove up 15 different charges that led to two convictions. And normally you can't get into evidence when a person testifies what we call an unadjudicated offense, because it hadn't been, it didn't result in a conviction.
You could get the two in, right, but you couldn't get the other.
So what happened, they had a hearing called a foreign, they called it a motion in limine. He had a hearing outside the presence of the jury, and really the defense lawyer didn't object about the unadjudicated offenses, and then he didn't object when they came in, and that waived error. So the jury found out during guilt or innocence phase that he'd been charged with 15 different robberies. Those are the only two major things and that happened in the appeal. As far as the writs are concerned, apparently they had very little merit, because when they filed a writ in state court, they didn't publish an opinion and didn't even have anything written. They just denied it outright. When they go into federal court and he files his federal writ, they deny it without an evidentiary hearing. I mean, they just promptly
just
said,
bam, bam, bam.
Bam, bam. And then the Fifth Circuit denied a certificate of appealability, and you can't find any written opinion in the federal system on this. Nothing was written. They just simply denied everything without a written order. We don't know what the grounds were on the federal writ or the state writ. They just simply, wham, bam, denied all of it.
Is that kind of like playing judge roulette, is it?
It's kind of like the federal system, I hate to say that. You know, they didn't even give him a hearing. There's also something screwy about it. I don't know why, but in the stuff that Elizabeth sent me, he also filed two motions to dismiss his own writ, and no one can understand why. Apparently, and you got the impression from looking at that, that maybe he and his writ lawyer were having some argument and he didn't want to proceed with the federal appeals. You get that impression because he asked him to dismiss the writs.
Could he have filed those writs himself through some kind of jailhouse lawyer?
Normally they don't, because it's really too hard to do generally. Yes. And so, again, like I say, in the federal system, there's absolutely not one word written about any of his grounds for error. No evidentiary hearings were given. They just promptly denied everything. In fact, it's not even, all of this was unpublished. You can't even find the denials. Because I went through LexisNexis last night and again early this morning trying to find something on him. And I found absolutely nothing in the federal reporters.
Hmm. And that's not usually the case.
No. Normally, in fact, usually on these federal writs at the district court level, they'll oftentimes give them an evidentiary hearing, and they'll often have something in the Fifth Circuit will publish something. And at least they'll write about it. They didn't bother to write about it. They had one good word, overruled. And that was basically it.
Hmm.
In fact, the Supreme Court the same way, nothing from them.
Nothing from any of those federal stuff at all. Okay. We're fortunate not to have Billy Wayne Sinclair with us, and Billy has been with us before on these programs. Billy, tell us about who you are and what's your interest in executions.
Well, I've previously served 40 years in the Louisiana prison system.
Yeah.
And
get a little closer to that microphone.
All right, let me get up here a little bit closer. How's that?
That's much better.
And of those 40 years, nearly seven of them were spent on death row. My wife and I have a second book, which is coming out, which will be released in March of next year, which is a critical analysis of the death penalty. The title of the book will be Capital Punishment, An Indictment by a Death Row Survivor. And the title really speaks to the book. I mean, it is an indictment of the death penalty, so anytime I have an opportunity and in a media situation to speak against death penalty, I'm gonna take advantage of the opportunity.
Well, I mean, you're here. I mean, anyone that's been through your experience get portfolio on this show to do what you want to do. What goes through your mind when you come down here and we're talking about somebody actually being executed tonight? How close did you come?
Well, you never, you know, one of the things I write in the foreword of our book is that I've never lost either the fear of the death penalty itself or the fascination that draws one to study the subject. And it is a fascination, sort of an abhorrent fascination. You wonder, in each particular case, as Jim was very clinically going through the details of the crime, you recognize that there are a lot of human factors that are at play behind that clinical analysis. He mentioned Broom, the jailhouse lawyer. It's in a human perspective, many inmates who are arrested for a crime, particularly a capital crime, are going to sit around jail because they're under a lot of pressure, they're under a lot of stress. And a lot of times they will inadvertently say things about their cases to one or more different people in community conversations within the bullpen of the jail, or in one-on-one conversations, apparently, as in this case, where you've got a jailhouse lawyer who is probably presenting himself as a person who can help him, as a person there to give him advice as to what his options may be. So there's this tendency to, in effect, talk too much, and I suspect that's what happened there. The fact that this guy's from New York and has prior robbery convictions and came to Texas, I doubt very seriously that he understood when he made the decision to come to Texas that he was entering the death penalty capital of the United States, and that the behavior that may have warranted a second degree or a lesser conviction in New York in the state of Texas is going to carry the death penalty, and when you get the death penalty in the state of Texas, they're going to carry it out. So, you know, there's a lot more in these cases, and that sort of things I look at. I look at, you know, what kind of, sort of look at the human aspects of what's behind this guy, other than just that he's another man being put to death on death row tonight.
How long has it been since you was on Louisiana's death row?
I was one of the Furman-released inmates in 1972.
Since then, they've changed the rule.
Oh, certainly, certainly.
What happened?
The biggest thing they did in the death penalty was in 1996 when Bill Clinton signed into law the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, which in effect reduced the capital punishment inmates' access to the federal writ of habeas corpus. In a very proverbial sense, he gets one bite out of the federal apple, the federal habeas apple. He gets one opportunity to go to federal court. Like Jim said, that in this case, the guy did not even receive a hearing.
It's buzzing.
Wrong line.
Hello. Wrong line. Nope.
Line.
Hello.
Fire the producer.
Okay, she's on now. Hello, you're on there. Just hang up. Hello, are you there? Hello? Push. What's the light lit up there?
Nothing.
Okay. Okay, we're trying to get to Huntsville. Apparently, there's a report coming from Kelly Epstein. I'm sorry, I got distracted.
That's perfectly all right. I understand.
I get caught up in the technology of what's going on here. We have a rather rude system. But it shortened the time people have and stacked things on top of one another?
It does. And now, in 2005, the Patriot Act, reauthorization of the Patriot Act was passed by Congress, which even curtails more the amount of time that an inmate has to seek federal habeas relief.
Kelly?
Yes, hey, Ray.
Are you there? What's happened?
Well, it's business as usual. We've just executed our 16th person this year with three more executions scheduled next week.
And the media came out and said...
No, there was no media, and unfortunately there were just four of us there on the corner, but we stood witness, but this is a very quiet one. He had nobody here from New York, and so there were four of us to witness, and the event was a very quiet, very quick one.
What was the indication you had that it was over?
Well, we know when the witnesses and the media come back out. In this case, there were no witnesses. He had no witnesses for himself, but we saw the media come back.
Yeah, Grazik was in there. He's always there.
Yeah. When the people on the corner leave, then they take down the yellow tape, and then the cars are allowed to go back through, and the event is truly over.
Well, we appreciate your calling, and if you're on standby next week, we'll have three occasions to talk with you. Maybe we'll get at least one stay out of that.
We're hoping for three. I think you'll be talking to Dennis Longmire. Thank God he'll be back next week. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to tell you what's going on.
Thank you, Kelly. Is there an organization of some kind up there?
An organization?
Or is it just an informal gathering of concerned citizens?
Well, that's right. And really, some of us are up here just from our own benefit. Some are members of TDA. ADP, some tax privacy, some, you know, other organizations, but it's a diverse crowd.
Okay, thank you, Kelly.
You're welcome. Bye.
Good night. And it's kind of strange to wish somebody a good night after they've just informed us that the execution is complete. Why don't we, Jim? From a lawyer's perspective, what about this hurry-up-the-process stuff?
Well, as I mentioned, they're just going to change. They're trying to change right now. Now you have a year to file a federal writ. They're trying to cut that down to 6 months to file your federal writ. And they're going to also put some time limitations on when judges can rule on these writs. And that's what they're trying to do, is speed everything up. And truthfully, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. In order to get a federal writ granted, you almost have to show that the judge is lying, the state judge courts are lying about the facts, or their decisions are irrational. They've made it so limited that it's virtually impossible, short of claiming the judges are insane at the state level, you can never get a writ granted. It's extremely, the only time you ever get one granted, if there's been some newly discovered evidence that made the state look horrible, like we talked about a case last week on an instance where a prosecutor put suborned perjury and put, and in cases like that, you can usually get a federal writ granted. And cases where there's actual innocence, you can sometimes get a federal writ granted. But as a general rule, it's just virtually impossible, because a lot of them don't even have lawyers at that stage of the
level. The quality of lawyers that handle, we'll be back, but the qualities of lawyers that handle these case, you know, are these fast draw lawyers? What?
Well, here's what they've done to try to change that. The trial lawyers have been pretty well improved. At one time, we had the famous Joe Cannon sleeping lawyer law. That's pretty well over with the trial level, because now most of the people, at least in major cities, who try capital cases are usually pretty qualified, and you're not going to have this normal sleeping lawyer. Plus,
no, but then we know that's no guarantee that's going to happen in Bell County.
That's true. And also, they have had several cases given the defense a lot more money to, in fact, we have pretty well unlimited funds to hire investigators and hire psychologists. Now, as a matter of fact, here recently in a juvenile case, Mike Snyder brought down an expert from Harvard, a PhD. They paid him $80,000-something to testify about the impact of drugs. Not even a capital case, it's just a juvenile case. Mm. So our courts have gotten pretty generous about that. Now, what they've done on the state level, they have a list of lawyers that the Court of Criminal Appeals have approved to handle writs. But that kind of, you know, ebb and flow on that, and unfortunately, my experience has been with a lot of these writ lawyers that I've read, they are padding the books and writing a bunch of nonsense, like execution last night. Everything they wrote in federal court and everything they wrote for the Bar Department of Pros, you just killed a tree for nothing, because the issues they brought up have been dead for 20 years. It was just a waste of time, truthfully. That's all they got. They're better off not writing a writ. And what I'm concerned about some of the writ some of the lawyers who are approved by the Court of Criminal Appeals, I think some of them are, feel like they're, if they bill more hours and stack more paper, they can get more money. And some of the things they write are just silly. Like, for example, they argued last week, or the execution last night, they argued about that the case had been decided 20-something years ago, and every case after that has followed it. And so I'm not really impressed with the representation from the writ level up. I've been fairly impressed with representation. For example, in this case, the person that did the direct appeal, at least I didn't read the trial transcript, but it seems to be rather thorough, and the trial lawyers seem to do a pretty good job in this case. But I have no idea what the writ lawyers did, because nothing was published. I couldn't tell you that.
Billy Wayne Sinclair, look at the same situation from the perspective of the guy who's standing at jeopardy.
Well, the one thing that Jim mentioned earlier when he spoke about the accessibility of habeas corpus, actual innocence at the federal level is not an issue that you can raise on federal habeas unless you support it with a constitutional violation. So you can go in and claim actual innocence, and that by itself is no, it does not give you a right to a writ of habeas corpus. You have to show that a constitutional right was violated, and if the Supreme Court has recognized this constitutional right and has ruled on it. So if you can't show that, which is almost impossible to show in a lot of instances, you're going to be denied federal habeas relief. Now, there was a former attorney general for the state of Missouri who argued before the Missouri Supreme Court that even if a death penalty inmate can go in and prove that he is actually innocent, he is truly beyond any doubt that he is innocent, if he received a fair trial, then he's not entitled to federal habeas relief. And that's the point that some prosecutors ask. That's the state that we're in right now when it comes to federal habeas relief and death penalty cases. When you've got the attorney general of a state going before a state Supreme Court and arguing that no matter if this man is innocent, that habeas relief was not available to him because there was no constitutional violation.
Well, who is benefited by this rush to judgment? Who is benefited?
Well, certainly prosecutors.
Politicians,
the law and order politician, but prosecutors. You have this rush to judgment now, and if you take and if you expedite the execution process, then all these cases, you've had 126 people released from death row since 1973. Who were exonerated because they were innocent. Now, if we've released 126 who have been exonerated because of actual innocence from death row, then how many have we executed since 1977, January 1977, when we resumed the death penalty in the United States with Gary Gilmore execution? We've executed more than 1,100 inmates since that time, and we have probably and almost certainly executed innocent people during that process. Well, if you expedite the post-conviction process, any errors committed tend to be covered up, ignored. I mean, there's no longer any interest in the case. You don't have inmates sitting on death row 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years with activist groups out there like you had in the Gary Graham case, like you've had in a number of other cases where they've actually been able to.
And all of that activism didn't work.
No, but they did raise enough doubt in the public mind that he garnered a lot of national and international support for his claims of innocence.
Well, activism did work in the Clarence Brantley case,
yeah,
but not in these other cases. While we're here, we've been listening to the lawyer's perspective, and we've been listening to Billy Wayne Sinclair's perspective, who is a laureate of death row in Louisiana. We now have a journalist on the line, and Justin Clark is a reporter for the Killeen Daily Herald. Justin, are you there?
I am. It's Justin Cox, actually.
Justin Cox. Okay, I'm sorry my notes are wrong, and I'm glad to straighten that out. I will not make that mistake again. My heavens name, mispronouncing the byline is not a good plan. Justin, you actually covered this case in part?
Actually, no. I never covered the case directly back in 2002, I believe, when it ran. I've only been covering it here recently. I talked to some of the friends and family of the victim.
Yeah. Oh, so you're after the trial, after the event coverage.
That's right.
Okay. However, there is a recent case, and we've been talking about it the last few weeks on Execution Watch, about the cell phones, and somehow or other you're involved in that story.
Yeah, that's right.
But now, in journalism school, didn't they tell you first person singular is X Nix?
Oh, yeah, and the last thing that a reporter wants to do is become part of the story, but it kind of locally here, that's a little bit of what happened.
Well, how did that come to be?
Well, it's the case of Richard Taylor. He was a Killeen resident for a very short time, and I covered his trial when he went back in March of last year, and then he actually received the death penalty on April 2nd, I believe.
Well, I understand he did not give very good reviews for your coverage.
Well, actually, I was actually a topic of conversation between he and a friend of his that were sitting at and watching the trial, the only person who came on his behalf outside of his mother and sister, and he actually called me about a month ago, and we had numerous conversations, about 10 of them, I guess. And hearing him, hearing the voice, it was very interesting, and he actually tried to
Interesting is an interesting word. How about spooky?
Yeah, it was a little spooky, but when you know Richard Taylor, you know he's really out for attention more than anything else. It was very funny.
And it comes across in this. I mean, I'm a friend of John Whitmire's politically.
Okay.
I've supported John for many years. John is not the bad guy on criminal justice issues by a long shot. But that someone would call John and try to intimidate him with threats against John's children is over the top.
I think that was exaggerated a little bit. I mean, Tabler never told me in the conversations that we had. He mentioned that he had a state senator on that he had spoken with, and I mean, actually, I think he called me first before he called the senator, or at least actually the senator's staff, but. He also had a private investigator working for him. I believe his mother hired him that way. And so he called me on my cell phone. That was the first conversation that we had, which that was a little weird.
And so the private investigator's got to figure out your cell phone number, right?
Oh, yeah, I imagine so. He never disclosed the cell phone or the private investigator information, but Tabler's a wild guy, and I went down to see him, and he was all smiles, and then he actually, the last time we talked was the day the story ran,
uh-huh.
And he called me up, and he wasn't real thrilled about the way I portrayed him, because I was frankly accurate.
Well, I mean, that's what your job is, isn't it? I mean...
Right. But getting to know the man, it was, and because, you know, you have a certain idea of what somebody is until you actually speak with them in person for a couple hours, and then speak to them on the phone, and, you know...
Well,
10 times or so.
I don't know how things work in Killeen, but is your beat the courthouse?
Yes, that's correct. I do the political beat and the courthouse.
You very busy in Killeen? I mean, there's a lot of crime stories going on?
Yeah, we have a lot of crime here in Killeen. We just we like to keep busy.
Do you cover the civil side, too, or just the criminal side?
Not the civil side, except for a few notable exceptions. The General Motors was sued, and their seatbelt company was sued, but pretty much just criminal.
What do you think generally about the idea of the cell phone scandal? You know, one of the things that Michelle Lyons, and you know who Michelle is, obviously.
Yes, yeah, the PIO for...
One of the things she said tonight on KPFT's Pacifica Evening News was, see how I do those plugs, she said that they hoped that making telephones accessible to general population will reduce the smuggling of cell phones. And she neglected to mention, but I remembered that it took four sessions of the legislature, 16 years, to get that law through the legislature.
Wasn't Texas the only state that didn't have that?
At the time we were actually... Maine was the last to fall, and then Texas, Maine actually has telephones now. Texas doesn't have telephones yet. But Maine fell 1 year in their legislative session, and then the next time Texas legislature met. I was really surprised because we'd gotten it through committee and we'd gotten it on the floor of the House, and it had been bottled up on the Senate because the governor didn't approve of it. And when it passed, the governor said he wasn't going to sign it, but something happened that it became law. Which usually requires a governor's signature, so I don't know how they procedurally did that, because I wasn't in Austin at the time. But it has been law since last summer. It was supposed to have been up and running by September the 1st, and they did the contract days before September, so it's in process now. But I would imagine putting telephone access to the general population inmate will reduce the smuggling.
Well, yeah, because people want to talk to their families. They want to talk to the outside world. I mean, Tabler told me that he didn't have any access to radios. Well, he wasn't supposed to have access to radios, but he managed to get iPods, phones, you know, you name it. He called me one night and he would talk about a shipment he just got in. And apparently he liked to see himself as the distributor
okay.
of death row inmates.
Okay, well, and you know they found one there today.
Oh, did they?
Yes, they found a cell phone and charger today.
Oh, no, I didn't. It doesn't really surprise me. I imagine they'll be finding him for a while.
Well, I explained you have two forces working. One thing, inmates don't have anything to do 24 hours, 7 days a week, but to sit around and figure out how to beat the man. And
of course.
With that much time, you can do that. And the other thing is the officers who've been supplying them need the money because since they've been getting the money, they need to pay the additional truck notes and add to their gun collections and bass boats. And they just live higher on the hog than they can in state salary.
I certainly know that at $1,300 a pop, which is about the going rate that the market down there was supplying, that's not a bad deal. And, you know, they're fairly trusting of their own people.
But, that, you know, once the officers get involved in that kind of contraband dealing, they can't stop because they're living at a higher standard of living than they could possible on state salary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you go there, you don't go back.
Is this the first you've ever heard of us here at KPFT?
I'm sorry?
Is this the first you've ever heard of us here at KPFT?
Yes, it is, actually.
Okay, well, get on the internet tomorrow night and listen to The Prison Show. We're on every Friday night from 9 o'clock. And if you run across any scoops that we need, don't forget us. And if we run across that you need, we won't forget you either.
All right, we'll do. Well, Taylor, since he lodged his appeals, he should be coming up sometime late next year. So.
Oh, well, you sit back and wait for your Peabody Award or whatever they do in journalism.
Oh, well, I won't hold out any hope.
Thank you very much, Justin Cox with the Killeen Daily Herald, and you can read him on that website. Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay. Well, he sounded like a nice young reporter covering the beat and lucked upon a real story. And as soon as Elizabeth gets the phone figured out, we can go back to our conversation. Is there anything that either one of you wanted to say that we didn't get around to saying, or shall I go on a witch hunt here?
I want to mention this on claims of actual innocence. The way lawyers get around them, as you well know, all habeas petitions have got to be based on a constitutional violation. And federal courts have been fairly lenient, not lenient, but they at least have been listening if you claim a due process violation where a prosecutor has hidden evidence they're supposed to turn over to the defense, which they've reversed a case recently, and instances where you have ineffective assistance of counsel. The problem on the actual innocent claims when the writs come up or where people recant testimony, there's where the problem comes in. Because when they recant testimony, like you've had the famous case in Atlanta where a bunch of witnesses recanted their testimony. The writ's not going to recognize that sort of thing. Now, there's also a real known avenue, at least not well-known avenue, but there's another avenue to get in that lawyers have tried called a writ of coram nobis, which means you've had a new body of evidence. The problem is with that particular type of writ is you've got to be able to demonstrate that you were unaware of and due diligence you couldn't have found it at the trial level. But as a general rule, most of your claims of actual innocence that they go up on a writ are usually done on a due process violation. You're alleging a due process violation, like a Brady violation, didn't give you information to the defense, or you're saying the lawyer is ineffective, which is a Sixth Amendment violation.
Mm-hmm.
The problem are these cases where witnesses recant testimony after they've testified at trial. Those are the ones that create the big problem with the writ level. When they claim they're actually innocent, that somebody lied back, blah, 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 back when the trial took place. There's where the problem comes in.
And so there's no handy remedy for the problem.
No, because, again, you know, what happens, the trial judge or the writ judge, the one that hears the recantation or hears a conflicting testimony, they're going to take his word pretty much at face value what he evaluates. And as a general rule, those trial-level judges who are closer to the public, who are closer to the politicians, are going to rule with the prevailing winds. And they're not as insulated from political pressure as some of your appellate judges are. So you got the worst possible judge hearing the case because they're the one closest to the public, closest to political winds, and more likely to be influenced by politics. And as we well know, the trend has been, as you know, like we know this in this past election, we had a gal running for judge. What was her campaign theme? I was the prosecutor who put the so-and-so on death row. In fact, you remember when McSpadden,
McSpadden
years ago ran for judge, and he was going to talk about putting the, some famous murderer on death row, and they finally pulled that ad back, and that was what he's advertising as a virtue of being a great judge. You never hear somebody, well, I'm the judge that suppressed a confession that kept a guy from going to death. You never read that, do you? Or I'm the judge that decided all the witnesses for the state were lying. I'm the judge that did that. Or I'm the judge that didn't believe the cops. As the old phrase goes, fingerprints don't lie, but liars take fingerprints. Well, you never hear one of them say that running for re-election, do you, Ray?
No, you don't. And I'm dealing with cop issues right even as we speak. It's an amazing world. Billy Sinclair, you not only have a book coming out, which is coming out again when?
In March of 09.
March of 09, and its title will be?
Capital Punishment, an Indictment by a Death Row Survivor.
And you've got a book that's already out.
Life in the Balance, yes.
Life in the Balance. Is there a handy place people can go to find out about Life in the Balance?
Yes, you can go to Amazon.com and order it.
Okay.
I don't know if any of the bookstores still have it on the shelf. I doubt very seriously. You order it online, though. You know, it's available online, definitely.
Yeah, and it's about your experiences. In
yeah, the first 35 years at my period of incarceration, last 5 years, of course, the book was out. You know, it came out in 2000, and I was released in 2006. So the book chronicles the 35 years before the book come out in 2000.
I can get into trouble here right quick because you and I haven't discussed some of these things. Prison is a culture.
Yes.
It's a different culture.
It is.
If you haven't experienced it, if you're going to survive that culture, you're going to have to learn how that culture works and adapt to it, or you won't survive.
Well, like you mentioned a while ago, Ray, you mentioned that inmates have 24 hours a day in which to do nothing but scheme on how to beat the man. And
some of them do that.
Yeah. But by and large, the bulk majority of inmates, it's like a larger society. The average inmate, all he simply wants to do is do his time, do his job, obey the rules, get by. The only ones you're going to see trying to subvert the system and trying to get over on a man or do the things he is not supposed to do are those that live and subscribe to the criminal ethic. I mean,
sure.
They've been criminal all their life, and nothing about prison is going to change yet. And before we run out of time, I would like to add one thing. I read in the paper where the incoming district attorney, Pat Lykos, has said that she is going to create a committee in the DA's office to give greater screening to potential death penalty cases to reduce the number of death penalties being handed out handed out here in Harris County.
Yeah, but she comes from the world's capital of that stuff.
Yeah, but if you have a DA elect who is willing to, in this community, to take a stand that we're going to try to reduce the number of death penalties being handed out in this county is a very positive thing. And I just like to, you know, it doesn't say the death penalty is going to be eliminated. It doesn't say the death penalty is not going to be handed out in Harris County. But it does say the prosecution's discretion on which cases to prosecute.
And the prosecutor, the district attorney, has enormous power.
You got it.
Enormous power in these cases, and to disperse that power over a group of people has got to be a more positive sign than not.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I believe it is. I believe that if you have a district attorney, incoming district attorney, that is concerned about the image of Harris County being the death penalty capital of the world, not just the United States, but of the world, because more death penalties are handed out per capita in this county than any other place in the world, perhaps short of China, you know, because we don't know how many are handed out.
Oh, they don't list the women, even in Iran.
They don't keep records like
Taliban doesn't count the women.
They don't keep statistics like developed countries do. But I think it is a positive sign, and we would be remiss to not mention it.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. And Billy Wayne Sinclair, thank you very much for coming down and joining us. This has been another edition of Execution Watch on KPFT HD2 channel, which is really not up, so you're listening to it on the Internet. And we have been discussing the execution of Denard Shea Manns, 42-year-old New Yorker, who was condemned for raping and robbing and shooting to death of Michelle Christine Robeson in her home in Killeen, Texas. She was a member of the United States military at the time of her death, as was her husband. His appeals were unsuccessful, and this evening, I'd say approximately 6:25, the execution was complete. Legal analyst again tonight was Jim Skelton. And our guest in the studio was Billy Wayne Sinclair. We want to thank him for coming down and doing this. We want to thank Justin Cox, who is a reporter from the Killeen Daily Herald, for joining us to talk about the telephone story and about his receiving recent calls from death row, which is not a usual circumstance. Reporting from Huntsville was Kelly Epstein, who's a social worker up there who goes to executions routinely to keep a vigil outside. And reporting from Houston was Dave Atwood, who is a founder and board member of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Next week, there will be three executions scheduled in Texas, and unless we get good news, we will be here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night of next week. Hopefully, there will be three stays. At least that's what Kelly Epstein was hoping for. I'd just love to have a day's break in the schedule. First up is Eric Dwayne Cathay, who is scheduled to be executed at 6 o'clock Central Time on Tuesday. Our producer is, of course, the capable Elizabeth Stein, and handling the electronic wizardry is none other than the very electronically talented Otis McClay, and we're going to play cut number 7 from Ellis Unit 1 by Steve Earle as our going out song. And we'll be back next week, but with luck, maybe not.